My name is Norma Barsman, and I wrote The Locket in 1946.
Let's start talking right away about The Locket, because you, your screenwriting credit, I understand, was cut.
Now, not because of the blacklist, you know. We won because it was really before the blacklist. We don't know exactly why my name was taken off. Probably because my husband wrote it with me. It was my idea, but he wrote it with me. We had both our names on it when we sold it to Hume Cronin, who was then at Paramount. He wanted to direct it, and he was going to play the psychiatrist. And then a play came up for him in New York, and he left town, and he sold The Locket to RKO. Now, all this is relevant because once RKO bought it, something seems to have happened. They put another screenwriter on it without telling us, and Howard Hughes bought the studio. Now, that's relevant because my husband wrote, the boy was writing at that very time, The Boy with Green Hair at RKO, and Howard Hughes was furious that, my husband wouldn't change it. It was, you know, for peace. I don't know if you know the film, The Boy with Green Hair. Anyway, he wanted my husband to write a line, which, of course, he wouldn't, to have peace in the world. The United States has to have the biggest army, navy, and air force in the world. And he wanted the little boy, the boy with green hair, to say that. Ben wouldn't write it, and I'm happy to say Dean Stockwell, the 12-year-old actor, wouldn't say it either. So anyway, Howard Hughes was very, very angry, and we suspect that since our film was also shooting at the same time, that he took our names off. And we were in Europe when we found out about all this, by the time we found out, and we talked to the Screenwriters Guild about it, and we tried to do something about it, and we never got credit. So that's pretty much the story of why we don't have credit. Isn't exactly the blacklist.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the blacklist, that era? I know the interest in the House of Un-American Activities Committee is in the news again, especially with films like Good Night and Good Luck being so popular. There's such an interest in that era, and you lived through it, and you were directly involved. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. Well, actually, the Hollywood progressive community in the 40s was simply wonderful. I don't know if anything like it ever existed in history, not Athens or anything else, because it was a group of people, a large group of creative people who really worked together, progressive people who just gave of themselves, not only to helping each other with films, but, of course, in the community. Now, some were communists and some were not communists, but we all worked together for the good of society. It sounds silly, but we all were trying in every way we could to make a better world. It sounds corny now, but that's what we did. Locally, community work. We got teenage Latinos, the Sleepy Lagoon Boys off. They were arrested for murder. This is the kind of thing we did when they were on one part of Los Angeles, and the murder that they were accused of was all the way across town, and they couldn't have done it. Teenagers. So we raised money for their appeal. We wrote pamphlets and told people about that. I'm telling you this because I think that period before the Cold War started, before they targeted us. And the reason that people like us were targeted was because we helped organize the labor unions in Hollywood. This is one reason why the moguls really, you know, went along with the blacklist. So it was a very wonderful period, and we were warned already in 1947. You know, it started much before McCarthy, the Waldorf Accords. I'm telling you too much now, but I don't know how much my book, The Red and the Blacklist, explains exactly how suddenly we were warned about it. And when we had a chance to go to England to make a film to break the blacklist, because Eddie Dimitrick, one of the Hollywood Ten, who later went to jail, couldn't work in the United States. A whole year he hadn't been working. But if we, if my husband wrote the screenplay of Christ in Concrete, he thought he could get it done in England. And he did. And we went to England with our two little kids. And after England, after making the film, which just came out DVD, Christ in Concrete, a wonderful film, we went over to Paris for what was supposed to be a three-week vacation, and it turned into 30 years because our friends in Hollywood phoned us to Paris and said, don't come back, there are subpoenas out for you, and you'll never work again here anyway. So we stayed in France, and I can't tell you much about what it was like in America during the 50s and 60s, the blacklist. I can only tell you that we had a really great life in Europe. We got to know Picasso, bought a house near him in the south of France, also bought a house in Paris, and got to know the most wonderful artists and writers of the left in Europe, and made a lot of good films. You see, I can't tell you a great deal about what it was like during the McCarthy years in America since I wasn't here. I was in France for 30 years, and The Red and the Blacklist, my book, tells about that wonderful period, as well as the 40s in Hollywood.
Speaking of the 40s in Hollywood, can you tell us how, you know, because film noir was such a popular...
Yes, it certainly was. We were all so excited about Italian films. I mean, they were our Bibles. And when I got the idea for this film, I wasn't thinking film noir. What I was thinking was this. I was a Marxist, and I was just beginning my analysis. It's kind of a funny story about my analysis, my psychoanalysis, because I don't know if you know Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance, but the young man in it says they were supposed to apprentice me to a pilot, to pilot ships, and instead they apprenticed me to a pirate. Well, I had a lot of allergy and a little asthma at the time, way back in 1946, and I had just been a newspaper reporter and feature writer. And I had quit my job to have a baby. So I had all this allergy and stuff, and they thought it was psychosomatic. And so they sent me to not an allergist, but an analyst. So I was really interested in analysis. The Communist Party, of which I'm very proud I was a member of for the years from February 1943 to February 1949, 6 years. Because as I told you, the kind of work we did was really very, very wonderful. And had nothing to do whatever with the Soviet Union or anything else. The American Communist Party in Hollywood was a very special thing and unlike any other, I guess, that ever existed. I know you asked me about film noir, but let me just tell you that I wrote this not thinking of film noir particularly. I was really trying to reconcile sort of Marxism and Marx and Freud. And in a way, you can see it with the picture. You've seen the picture, so you know that the social, right? The social, you see that the reasons are both social and psychological. And that's what I was mainly interested in when I was writing it.
Can you talk a little bit, too, about how you did the nesting flashbacks?
Oh, yes, the flashbacks. That was my idea, and my husband, who was 10 years older than I and already a very successful screenwriter, hated the way I wanted to use the flashbacks. He said, flashback can only be used to advance the story. You can't do that. Well, of course, I fought for it, and I won. And I think it really is a wonderful thing about the film. I know that critics, I was amazed later on how film critics fastened on that and loved the way I used flashback to tell really what was going on. And you know more and more about how her mind works and why she is the way she is. And, I mean, I think I don't know of any other film that does that.